Anyone that was here that stood up that's under a year clean, please see Jesse after the meeting. Thank you. Wow. That then gets your blood pumping. I don't know what does. Whew. Wow. That just, it kind of makes the weekend right there. Seeing all this clean time, seeing everybody stand up just puts me in touch with gratitude and humility that I have for Narcotics Anonymous and how I am so grateful to be a part of this wonderful fellowship. Now it's time to introduce the speaker. I met the speaker about 5 minutes before the meeting started. I know when I first came into the program, I learned a lot about commitment and consistency and vigilance, responsibility, a lot of words that it just seems to me some days that I don't hear a lot of anymore. But I know when I came into the program, I was told to say yes to what was ever asked of me in Narcotics Anonymous, that I had to chase my recovery like I chased a bag of dope. And for this gentleman to come from Florida to share this experience with us, this weekend with us, shows me commitment, shows what this program is all about, and how we all learn how to live this program in our daily lives. I am so looking forward to hearing what he has to say. I'm just going to give you Vito L. from Florida.
I don't know if this will work in here or not. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm an addict called Vito.
Hey, Vito.
Hi, family. First off, I'd like to get some thank yous out of the way. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come here because, believe me, it's a privilege to be allowed to come and share recovery with other people. I'd like to thank the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous for keeping me clean and keeping me alive because I know in my heart I would not be alive today. And it was rooms like this that kept me coming. And last but not least is my relationship with my higher power. Because without that relationship, I wouldn't be here today. And while I'm talking, I may mention the word God a few times. If that scares you, talk to your sponsor about it because he's in our steps and he was here long before me and you. And I'm not ashamed of the word God. I know when I came in here as agnostic, I didn't want to hear that. And I know newcomers today don't want to hear that. But I do have a personal relationship with God as I understood God, and it continues today even though it evolved and changed. I do a lot of conventions, and I usually get up and I say, do the same thing practically, you know, over and over and over again. But this is not a regular convention. This is a history thing. And so I feel that to go up there and give the regular circuit thing that I do all the time wouldn't give justice to this weekend. You know, I have to tell my story and where I was along the way as I evolved from my personal history in Narcotics Anonymous. But normally I'll get in, tell my story, get into the 12 steps, go through all 12 steps, or go through the traditions. And I'm up here and I'm feeling inclined not to do that. But, you know, I don't never know what's going to happen up here, so I may go that way anyway, but I don't think I am. First of all, I grew up in this program. I came in as a young man, 21 years old. I grew up in a place called the Bronx. My father went out for a loaf of bread, so to speak, and never came home. I had a mother who was the first liberated woman in the world because she wouldn't ask for support from him and went out and worked two or three jobs, which gave me the freedom to be me. And I learned very young, in the mid-1940s, on the stoop of my building, what addiction was all about. You know, I was introduced to something that was called in the street in those days called sticks, which was pre-rolled reefers, real thin, like a little twig. And the love of my life for the first few years of addiction, Carbona. Now, if you're not from New York, you may not know what Carbona is, but it's a form of dry cleaning fluid. And all the little kids in my neighborhood would go to school and were constantly sniffing our handkerchiefs. And I remember we got a new teacher in the neighborhood, and she says, "What's wrong with this neighborhood? All the kids got sniffs all the time." And well, you know, with Carbona, you soak it in the dry cleaning fluid, and all day long you just keep sniffing your handkerchief. But when I hit about 10 years old, I found the real love of my life. And I had a 11-year relationship with that love. I was introduced to mainlining heroin. And from the first day, I chased that feeling that I got the first time. And it took me to places that I didn't want to go, places that I didn't think that somebody like me should be. But it took me to those places. And things were happening within me that weren't there when I was a little boy. Because when I was a little boy, I did have the ability to feel and to cry. But as I got older in my teens, I remember one time, one of my buddies was a super. And in New York, what a super is, he gets a free apartment, takes care of the building, and usually has an apartment down the building. And so he had the run of the basement, and we and a few of the other guys in the neighborhood, we go down there and play cards. One of our friends was in the back of the room in an old chair sitting there, and he had his own personal game. It was called Russian Roulette. And he won. He blew his brains out in front of us, and I didn't have the ability to feel. The only thing that I got was annoyed that we had to take the game somewhere else. Today I can look back and realize my feelings were froze. I didn't have the ability to feel. And I used every day from the first time I picked up that needle until 1956, when I got involved in a gun battle in a place called Orchard Beach in the Bronx. Now, in the Bronx at Orchard Beach, the way the beach was set up, as you walk into a pavilion, every section was by neighborhoods. And dare you not go to a section that was not your neighborhood. But guys like me who are addicts always think the girls are better in the other neighborhoods. So there was always turf wars, and they weren't drug turf wars in those days. They were territory turf wars. And that day, a whole bunch of things happened. The guns came out. Somebody called the man. We threw the pieces in the Sound, because Orchard Beach is on Long Island Sound, and the man showed up. And I'm going to be the smart addict. I'm going to be the great guy who never gets caught. There was woods over on my right, and on the other side of those woods was a place called City Island, where you can get a bus back to the main part of the Bronx. So I take off through these woods and find myself in the middle of the New York City Summer Police Academy. Now, rookie cops back in those days, I don't know about today, wore gray uniforms to distinguish them from the regular cops. So I had all these gray people coming after me. It was late in the day, and they threw me in the paddy wagon, and I had to go downtown to Manhattan for night court, because everything was closed up in the Bronx. And I go and I get arraigned in night court, and they lock me up overnight because I'm going to be transferred to Bronx County in the morning in a place called the Tombs. Now, I had no idea what the Tombs were, but after I got there, I realized what they were. It was back from Civil War days, built under Manhattan, and I detoxed for the first time in my life in that cell. I woke up that morning, and you know when you get the razor blades in your belly and you start wanting to go in the fetal position, and they're coming and they're getting me to bring me downstairs to the paddy wagon again to transfer me up to Bronx County. And I get to Bronx County, and I'm in full-fledged withdrawal now, and I have to go through intake. And finally, they got me upstairs in my cell, overlooking Yankee Stadium, by the way, and I'm on a fetal position on the ground. And, you know, my head just wanted to have the relationship with the toilet bowl because all the fluids in my body wanted to come up. And I remember laying on that floor and banging my head on the bars, trying to create pain in my head because I couldn't stand the pain in my body. And the guards coming by spitting on me because addicts were the lowest thing on earth. But I was in that cell for 30 days, and I detoxed in there, and I was called for a meeting before the Bronx County District Attorney. When I got in there, they offered me a deal. For some reason, I had a charmed life. I always found enablers. They said to me, "Vito, if you will leave the state of New York, we'll offer you probation." Sound like a good idea to me. So I immediately moved to Jersey City. Now, if you know the metropolitan New York area, I get a furnished room in a place called Journal Square where they have the tubes, the Pat Tubes, which is a subway that runs from New Jersey to New York. So I'm still in New York on a daily basis. But this time I am clean. The first time in my life. And so now I could practice what I always wanted to practice, to be a good thief and a good gangster. So I make a commitment to myself, I will only use on weekends. It worked for about 2 weeks. And then I went on another 5-year run, 4 or 5-year run, and that run was almost all blackouts. I don't remember much of it. I know I woke up on railroad tracks, under people's porches, all over. And it ended on February 14th, 1960, in a gutter in East Orange, New Jersey, a place called Brick Church Station. I had crawled out of the dumpster that I was living. And this high-class heroin addict was too sick to go out and cop. I was finding mouthwash and Bayrum hair tonic in the dumpsters, finding stale bread and draining it through the stale bread just to get a little relief and have something. And I was sick, and I didn't know why I was sick, because I wasn't getting the heroin to be sick. And I was going to go to Brick Church Station, which was just outside the alley, and panhandle some stuff and get some money. And I passed out in the gutter. And it was snowing that day, and it was cold. And I lied in that gutter with the snow covering me up and people stepping over me like I didn't exist. And I think most people in this room know what it means to be a nun person in a crowd of people. Finally, somebody had some compassion and called an ambulance. And that was not an easy trick back in those days, because you had to go find one of these things that Superman changed his clothes in, called a phone booth. Then you had to take money out of your pocket and drop it in and call operator, because there was no 911 then. And they went through that trouble, and they came, and they picked me out of the gutter, and they brought me to the emergency room. And when I got to the emergency room, the doctors would not touch me. They told the nurses, he's covered with body lice. You must delouse him before we'll even look at him. And so they got me deloused, and the doctors looked at me, and they told me I was suffering from both infectious and serum hepatitis, from dirty living and dirty needles, and that I was contagious. And they put me into what was known as an isolation ward. And that meant only hospital staff and doctors could go in there. And that's where I found my next enabler on the way to recovery. Since I was admitted to the hospital on something called service, which was a nice fancy word back in those days for being on welfare, because I had no funds, so they had to admit me on service, I got a half doctor, an intern. And this guy was from Greece. And he would come in, and he would talk to me, and he was friendly. And one day he said to me, he says, you know, the man comes to the hospital, they want to talk to you to find out why you were living the way you were living or what was going on. And we tell them that they can't come in because you're contagious. But you'll be getting out of here in about a week. I want to offer you an alternative. Now, I didn't know what that meant, but I still knew it was still cold outside. And up here in the north, you know what it is like in March. It's still pretty chilly. So I figure I'd take a gamble on what he's talking. I said, well, what is this place? He said, well, we got people that are similar to you, and that if you would sign these papers, they might forget about you. Now, I didn't know what people similar to me meant. I did not know what upstairs meant. But when it was time for me to get out of there, my worldly possessions was in a brown paper bag that they made me wear, this hospital gown where your butt's sticking out the back end. And I get on the elevator with the nurse, and we go upstairs. I think it was on the 7th floor. And the elevator opens up. And in that, when it opens up, you see bed after bed after bed after bed. I says to the nurse, what is this place? She says, this is an alcoholic ward. And I looked at her and saying, what are you putting me with them sick people for? And she says, aren't you an addict? I says, no, not really. I abuse it a little bit, but I can stop anytime I want to. And she says, why didn't you? I said, because I didn't want to. So I said, I don't think it's fair putting me in with those people. And she says, well, you don't have to go. You can take your brown paper bag and you can leave. Well, I'm not the brightest light bulb on the street, but I knew it was cold out. So I took my brown paper bag, and I go all the way to the back of the room. There was an empty bed against the wall. And I had a thing with walls. All through early recovery, my back could never be exposed. And a lot of men are that way. And so I find this bed against the wall, and I figure I'm not going to associate with any of these people. I mean, they're sick people. I don't want to catch what they got. Well, after I got settled in, they told me there were certain things I had to do. I had to be in bed by 1 o'clock. Because they had no structure. There was no therapy. People played cards all the time. And I had to go to this meeting that came in every Wednesday night. And it wasn't from this fellowship. It was from another fellowship. And I immediately told the nurse in my infinite wisdom, I don't go there. I don't want to catch what they got. They're sick people. And she told me I could leave. So I agreed to go to the meeting. And when they would come in, I'd be against the wall like this with my back, one foot up. And I'd be snickering to myself all these stories that they told. Then something happened to me that changed my life. I got friendly with an old man in that facility. And back to a 21-year-old kid, an old man with a 40-year-old. And this old man would rap with me. And this guy, you know, he was like us. You know, you want to talk about God, he was on a first-name basis. You want to talk about ending the Cold War, which was a big deal back in those days, he had the solution. Everything you talked about, he knew everything about it. He was a know-it-all, just like me. And I guess that's why I gravitated towards him. But the day came when he was leaving the hospital, and he went into the back room, and he came out in his street clothes. And it shocked me, because he was a Skid Row bum. He had a navy pea coat on with no elbows in it. His elbows were protruding. His pants had all holes in it. His shoes, his toes were sticking out. And I looked into that man's eyes, and that day I realized there was no difference between me and him except our drug of choice. And so after that, when the people came in, I would listen. And I could relate at a deeper feeling. And then it was time for me to be released. And they gave me a meeting list. And they told me the magic words for a homeless person. If you come to our meetings, we have coffee and cookies. That's a pretty big invite when you're homeless. And that night, I showed up to the first meeting that was on that list. And I walked in. Now, you got to remember, this is 1960. I have hair almost down to my butt. I have motorcycle boots with spikes sticking out. I have a Garrison belt, a razor sharp, and I walk in, and I think there was only one woman in the room, and the rest were men with jackets and ties on. And here I walk in, and they're over at that end of the room, and everybody turns around, and there's like silence. And finally, this one guy comes up to me, and he says, "Hey, kid, what are you doing here?" And I explained to him, I got this meeting list, and I was in this hospital, and people came in, and they told me to come here for coffee and cookies. And his answer was, "Kid, the coffee and cookies are there. Help yourself. But this is a closed meeting for Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like you don't get better. You have a disease that is illegal and immoral. Help yourself to the coffee and cookies and leave." But he took my meeting list from me, and he looked at it, and he made some circles on it. And he says, "You can go to these meetings. These are called open meetings. But kid, don't waste your time. You're not going to get better. One thing you don't do is tell an addict not to come back." So I would show up at these great big speaker meetings. I mean, they're about the size of this right here. And I would sit down, and people would shift to the other side of the room. I don't know if I smelled, but they would shift. And what was happening right then in 1960, there was more and more people who looked like me begin to show up. And we would stand in front of the church and we'd share deep with each other like, "Hey man, what's happening?" Hey, that was deep sharing. And we'd go inside and we'd sit down and we sort of sat together. The meeting would be over. "See you tomorrow." That was our relationship. But we felt secure by just seeing each other. And I was sitting, I think it was the end of 1962, in Vailsburg section of Newark, New Jersey. There was a meeting. It was right around the corner from the Pabst Blue Ribbon Brewery, right on the Garden State Parkway. And I'm sitting there with the guys, and somebody came up and tapped me by a nickname they gave me in those rooms. Cannot still to this day figure out why they gave me that nickname. Animal. "Hey, Animal, there's a drug meeting in the back room." And myself and the herd of animals, we go to the back room. Didn't know what to expect. And there were people back there that had long hair and girls that had flowers in their hair and dresses down to their ankles. They were the love children, the hippies of that generation. And this particular group came out of San Diego, California. And what they were doing was going cross-country, and they were hitting all the communes, which I'm not going to go bother explaining what they are if you didn't live through that area. It's just too much to tell you. And then they would rent the back room of the other fellowships, and they carry this message that they picked up out there called Narcotics Anonymous. And the only piece of literature they had was this off-colored white book, almost beige. And they would open the meetings up, and they start reading. And felt comfortable with them because they had long hair and they wore T-shirts. The only difference is their hair was clean and their T-shirts were clean. I was a grease ball. My skin turns to Vaseline every night at 9 o'clock. Back then, I didn't wash my face. But they started to share. They opened the meeting up, and I started to hear my thinking coming out of their mouths. And then some of the local people who I sat with, because we weren't allowed to share at the other place, started sharing, and I started to hear my thinking coming out of their mouth, too. And then they allowed me to share. The first time after sitting in the rooms about 18 months that I was allowed to open my mouth. And the hippies stayed for a while and moved on. They were called rabbit meetings back in the 1960s. And when they left, we were clean, but we didn't know what the hell to do. You know, we just didn't know except stay close with each other. You know, we tried starting some of the meetings like they had, and we just couldn't get the structure. But we found out we could find more people like us if we went to the meetings at the other fellowship and proselyte their people, bring them back with us. And one day we met two people that had just got out of two new facilities that opened up in Manhattan, Daytop and Phoenix House. And they told us, well, we know all about recovery. We just graduated. Hey, what do we know? So they said, it's very simple. When you open up a meeting, anybody shares anything sick, you put them in the hot seat and start confronting them. I mean, that's all they knew. So we did it. The chairs start flying. The tables turned over. You know, so I had to go to the other fellowship. And then one day I found the meeting in Passaic, New Jersey, and it was the Narcotics Anonymous from New York, the Danny Carlson. The Ray Lopez was running that meeting at that time. And so I felt safe there, but it was one step under what this fellowship had to offer. It wasn't quite group therapy, but it was a little bit different. And they used the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I really didn't have much places to go. I wandered in and out of the AA fellowship. I tried starting NA meetings. I went there for a while. But I kept in contact with this one guy who went back to San Diego. I had a ritual with him. I'd call him up once a week. And he would say to me, why don't you move out here to California? We got some of this NA stuff going. Well, I said to him, I just can't do that. I have a living to make. Now, I haven't got to work yet, but I got a living to make. He says, Vito, you don't work. What are you talking about? Now, back in those days, if you suffered from alcoholism or drug addiction, you could get put on welfare. It's not like today. And they would send you two checks a month. Then you go down the pool hall and play nine ball all day long, and you make a living. So I said, I got a job. I play nine ball. He says, we got pool halls out here, and we got welfare here, too. So I started hitchhiking across the country. And I remember I arrived there in San Diego on a Wednesday morning, and I find a phone booth. And back in those days, phone booths to me were like having a cell phone. Because if you live on the street, you learn that if you take the top half of the phone off, that little screw around the receiver part where you hear, there was two metal prongs on there. And when the operator would say, deposit 75 cents or deposit 10 cents, you take that and hit it against the coin collector, and it goes ding. And if you wanted 75 cents, you go ding, 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 ding. So I had my own private cell phone in every corner in the country. So I called this guy up, and I said, I'm here. He said, where you at? And I looked around. I found the street sign. I said, so-and-so. He said, stay there. I'll come and get you. And he came to get me, and he lived in Old Town in San Diego, and he had a pad there. And we're sitting in his apartment, and he says, we have two NA meetings a week here, and you're lucky. Tonight is Wednesday, and we have a Wednesday and Friday meeting. Great. So I'm hanging around his apartment all day long, people coming in and out, just like drug dealers, in and out, in and out. Well, about 6 o'clock, his apartment was filled. There were about 15 guys there. He says, we're going to go to the meeting. And we go downstairs, and he's got this Volkswagen bus, a red Volkswagen bus, if you guys can remember what they look like. And we all pile into it. And we're taking off, and we go up to a place called Mission Hill. There's a very big Catholic church up there. And I'm getting out of the van, and he says to me, "Now, Vito, when you get out of this van, do not mention N.A. or Narcotics Anonymous." So I thought you were taking me to an N.A. meeting. I was all excited. He says, "Yeah, but the priests don't know that we're N.A. They think we're A.A. because they won't rent to any damn addicts." So it shows you how resourceful the addicts can be. The other meeting was on Friday night, and our landlords had no problem with us as long as we paid the rent. It was the Black Panther Clubhouse. The rest of the week, we had to go where we had to go for recovery. But those of us that stick together, we talk about the steps, and talk about the steps different than they talked about in AA. And I'm not going to go into the steps at this point like I normally do. I have to start telling on myself a few things. First of all, I'm now in recovery a couple years, and I've never had a sponsor. Because my justification was, I would never ask a sick person to sponsor me, because I'm well in my mind. The second thing is, I have never worked a step. Other than the fact that I told a guy, well, he said, "Where are you with the steps?" I said, "I'm done. I've heard them read every night for a couple of years." And I think we've got a few people around like that now. But I started to see people getting better. And I would still wait for somebody to relapse so I could roll them. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe there was something to this sponsorship. So I asked somebody, I went out in faith, and I really didn't want to do it, and I did it against the grain, asked somebody to sponsor me, and damn it, they said yes. And that person took me through the steps. And I was still crazy, I was young, I hadn't used my real name till I was in my 30s. I had a nickname that I got in my family, and I used it all the way up until I was 30, till somebody finally said to me, and I believe it was a sponsor, said, "Don't you think it's about time you use your name?" A 33-year-old guy doesn't walk around saying, "My name is Ducci." And I was sick. I was sick. I hung around with all the sick people, because I got an excitement out of it. If somebody wanted to go out and talk about robbing someplace and I'm in recovery, I would get excited. I mean, it was a rush. But I stayed around long enough to begin to get something. And I got a little something in San Diego, and I decided to go back to school. And I went off to Hong Kong, and I went to school there. And I spent a couple years there with my education. Of course, there was no N.A. there. I had to go other places. Then I came back, and I came back to Santa Barbara. And I started to work a program, and I started to get better. And I decided I would get a job. Now, I'm in recovery quite a few years now, and I finally make a decision to get a job on my own. And I got a job. And once I got the job, I was transferred to a place called Binghamton, New York. And that is right on the border of Pennsylvania. And I got a place, a town called Montrose, Pennsylvania. It was in commuting distance of Binghamton. And I started to go there for recovery. I was going to the other fellowship. And in 1976, I started a meeting on the corner of Henry and Shenango Street in Binghamton, New York. And that meeting is still there, because they invited me to speak there this year. But I still only was alone with that one N.A. meeting. And then I got transferred again. And I got transferred, and I got a house, and I bought a house. I actually bought a house in a place called Tunkhannock, Pennsylvania, which is halfway between Binghamton and Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And I would go into Wilkes-Barre to try to find meetings, and there was AA meetings. So I would still drive to Binghamton. And then I started a meeting with a bunch of guys from the AA Fellowship in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And when we did that, we found out there was meetings up in Scranton, which is only about 15 miles north of Wilkes-Barre. And there was guys up there that were instrumental in starting those meetings, Vince M. and Gino, and it was started in a pizza shop in Pittston, Pennsylvania. That was the first meeting in northeastern Pennsylvania. And I caught up with these guys, and I found out they had two meetings, a Wednesday and a Friday meeting in Dunmore, Pennsylvania. And they had one meeting in Exeter, Pennsylvania. And they had just broke off from something that was called the Northern Pennsylvania Area Service. And what they used to do is they would meet with the Southern Pennsylvania once every 3 months as a Pennsylvania area and then split off. And they just broke off from this Northern and started what was called the Wyoming Valley Area Service. And I got very involved with it, and I watched that part of that area grow. I watched the Scranton part of it grow. And I went to meetings down in Wilkes-Barre, and I started about 10 meetings in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. And we were going along good, and I felt that I was plugged in and that I had some recovery under my belt and I had a place to go. And then we had a guy move into town from California, and he was a graduate of Synanon. And he started chairing meetings and giving people their drinking rights. He would sit and chairing an NA meeting and say something, "You're 90 days clean now? Now you can go out and drink." And I remember the day that area service was, and myself and a bunch of guys from Wilkes-Barre, we went to area service and we said, "These meetings where this guy is longing and chairing must be taken off the meeting list. He's giving drinking rights." And they said to us, "We don't care what he does." And that area service meeting for Wyoming Valley Area Service was at St. Stephen's Church in Wilkes-Barre, PA. And 9 groups from Wilkes-Barre walked out of that area service meeting, went upstairs to another meeting room upstairs, and started the Beehive area of Narcotics Anonymous. They told us we would not succeed. Within 6 months, the Wyoming Valley Area Service died, and there was not one meeting left in Scranton. And that's a scary thing. You know, in the text it says if it's not spiritual, it's not practical. And if it's not spiritual, things will die. And some of those meetings, like the meetings in Dunmore, been there since the early 70s. But they died. Today there are meetings in Scranton, and there is an area in Scranton called Steamtown. But it took almost 10 years for the Scranton Fellowship to be revived and be built again. So if you think that meetings will always be there, you're wrong. You're wrong. And Pennsylvania was a good place for me. I really met a lot of neat people here. I really got plugged into recovery. But I was a working man now. And when the company said transfer, I went. And I got transferred to Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, by this time, I'm a radical. I'm crazy. And I'm going to disrupt anything that you have if it isn't what I believe is Narcotics Anonymous. And I had a rocky road in Charlotte, North Carolina, because they said, "Don't come down here and tell us how you did it up there." The basic text was already out, and they had big books on the table. And so I caused a lot of problems until I moved out of the city of Charlotte to a place called Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is right on the border of North and South Carolina, right outside of Charlotte. And they had an area there called Southern Foothills, which was tied up with Gastonia, North Carolina. And there was no H&I, there was no support from the area. And so me and my troublemaking, I said, "We need our own area here." And of course, everybody said it couldn't work. But it did work. And today it's bigger than their parent area ever was. You see, if it's going to be, and Narcotics Anonymous is going to continue to grow, you have to be part of the solution. If it's going to be, it's up to me. That's just the way it's going to be. If it's going to be, it's up to you. You have to get involved. You have to take recovery seriously. Now, you heard people talking all weekend long about the excitement of going through the literature process, about being part of it, open participation. Well, you know, we became a bunch of fat cats because there is no more literature committee per se. There is no more open participation. That excitement of writing a book is gone. Your areas and your regions as you knew them are going to be gone, very simply. The inverted pyramid of the 9th tradition, where the individual group member is the most important person, is on the verge of disappearing. Your car, which you vote on every year, is about ready to disappear. Group conscience is about ready to disappear and being replaced with what is called consensus. Now, if you don't care, that's okay. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but I'm saying it's wrong for me. Because I need to belong with something where I'm part of. And somebody said to me once, why don't you believe in consensus consciousness? Well, the first reason is I haven't known that we voted to get rid of the second and ninth tradition. But you could be in some places in Narcotics Anonymous and the second and ninth tradition doesn't exist. When was the last time that a regional motion hit the floor of the World Service Conference? They talked about earlier when the text came out, it tripled in size in about a year. I'm not sure if you know that in the United States over the last 8 years, we've been shrinking in size. We're growing worldwide as a fellowship, but we're shrinking in the United States. If that's not enough to concern you, remember how an area disappeared in a short period of time. I love Narcotics Anonymous, and I am not anti-NAS or anti-world. I'm pro-Narcotics Anonymous. I'm pro-group conscience. I'm pro-recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. And I know people that have been around here less than 15 years, 20 years, have gotten clean and are getting clean in Narcotics Anonymous, and that is wonderful. I'm not saying the literature that we have today stinks, because people do get clean, and I respect that. But I could see a vision beyond that, that excitement like when they wrote the text, of all those people getting involved and their lines being put in that book, that excitement being part of. That can happen again. Our literature today is not written by addicts for addicts. We have professional writers. And the logic that I hear coming down from the other side of the pyramid is that it takes too long for the process, and it's too costly for addicts to write for themselves. Well, ask those guys that were on the literature committee who wrote the basic text. The text was written in 2.5 years with no money, no funding from Narcotics Anonymous. They created their own money. They did it. When they mailed out the grade book, they had to raise $50,000. And do you know that they donated to WSC, the literature committee? Now, if they could write a book in 2.5 years and not have to take hundreds of thousands of dollars, with our modern technology today, you're telling me it can't work? Wouldn't it be right nice to have the basic text and then an advanced text or some other type of book written by addicts for addicts? I think about it, I get excited. I start to get that high like when I thought of robbing the place. It might sound weird, but I'm an addict. And when I could get obsessed over things, it's a wonderful thing. I remember when I was poor and had hardly any money and I wanted to go out of town to a function, I would say it's God's work to go to the local used car lot and take their car without them knowing it, because I'm going to put it back when I get back. Well, I could see that same excitement in me, but in a positive way of thinking about doing our literature again. When we had a literature committee, the fellowship grew and grew and grew. Is it because they wrote the literature? No. The reason was that the process of writing the literature, being part of it, that addict, that newcomer coming in, and what he has to say can be looked at by everybody else, and they can say, wow, that's great, and incorporate a word or a sentence. How exciting is that? When John shared this afternoon, he found the first step that his group wrote in the book. Isn't that exciting? There are people that mailed things in and it was cut and pasted and it's in the book. How much more exciting can it be? But you know, if we get rid of the inverted pyramid, and I hope everybody in this room knows what the inverted pyramid of the ninth tradition is. If not, I'm going to open my mouth and say something. The inverted pyramid is like this. The very bottom, the most important person in Narcotics Anonymous, that's the group member. That person is so important that they can make a motion in group conscience, it could pass, and the GSR could take it to the area. Now, the group is accountable to the member. The area is accountable to the group, not the other way around. And you could vote on the area level and take it up to the region. And if it passes there, the region delegate can take it to the World Service Conference. And it can be put on the floor and voted on. Well, that doesn't happen anymore. The tradition's still there. But it's not done anymore. You know why? Because people just don't care. I had people tell me this week at meetings, well, I don't care what happens at that end. All I care about is the meeting. This will still be here in my recovery. When we start taking things for granted, we get complacent. And you may not recognize your fellowship. When people are chairing meetings today on Suboxone, and any of the pharmaceutical companies will tell you, that is drug replacement therapy, DRT. It's not going to the doctor because you're sick or have a pain in your back. It's to replace one drug with another. It's the same as what methadone was. And the drug that methadone was designed to replace, heroin, you know where that came from? It was manufactured as drug replacement therapy for veterans coming back from the First World War who were addicted to opium. And we created a new addiction. Heroin was drug replacement therapy, and they had to come up with methadone, another drug replacement therapy, to get them off the heroin, and now they're coming up with Suboxone. Now, if it works for people and it gets them detoxed, I think it's wonderful, because Suboxone, by the researchers that developed it, it was a 5-day detox thing. And you can detox wonderfully on Suboxone. Stay on it longer than 5 days, you got a new addiction. I live in Miami, and on the street, Suboxone selling at $35 a pill, and if you pay $35 for a pill, it must be pretty damn good. But you know, we turn our heads, and we manipulate and say, in times of illness. It talks about in times of illness. They're not talking about drug replacement therapy. They're talking about when you're sick and you have pain in between you and your doctor and your sponsor. But drug replacement therapy is replacing one drug with the other. I remember the days when people were on methadone and their dose was being cut each month and they could not wait until they got down and off of methadone so that they could be a speaker at a meeting and participate in service. It was important to them. They had a goal. But it's not that way anymore. People turn their back. People come on methadone. They could be equal members. Yes, you could be equal members as a member of Narcotics Anonymous, but you can't serve until you're clean. And all of a sudden, we threw our traditions away and we have a new definition of clean time. If the therapist says, take this, you're clean, then you're clean. But not the Narcotics Anonymous that I went to and the Narcotics Anonymous that I believe I'm going to today. Recovery process does not start until we are clean. Total absence. Anybody heard that line before? It's in the basic text. It doesn't start until we become clean. Yeah, could you come to a meeting on Suboxone or methadone? Of course you can. You're a member when you say you are. But membership requires responsibility. And that responsibility means working towards getting clean, because that's what we're all about. But in 10 years or 20 years, if we don't get off our duff and become part of the solution, total absence will not be around anymore. And we need to be able to be part of it. We need to be able to get involved in our own recovery. I believe everybody has a right to come to Narcotics Anonymous, whether you're using or not using, but we're there to set the example. And if we write our own literature, I know as a fact the people that would get involved with that would write an IP on total abstinence. There's a number of them that have been written through the years, but not have been... It didn't even get down to group conscience for the groups to make that decision. But yet people will stand by and say, well, I don't want to get involved at that level. I worry about my home group. That's where I get involved. Here, let them take care of that. Well, a corporation is a corporation. How are corporations driven? By profit. Our fellowship outside the United States is growing in leaps and bounds. Look at Iran. But if you went to a meeting in Iran, you wouldn't recognize Narcotics Anonymous when you have armed guards there. When you don't have the freedom to practice God as you understood Him. And I realize that's the only way that addicts can get clean in those countries, and I say, go for it, it's a wonderful thing. But I live in the United States of America, and I live in a culture that's free. And I want a Narcotics Anonymous the way we had it. And I know in China, they're working hard now to get the fellowship going there, but it'll be a closed fellowship there too, under government scrutiny. And if addicts in China can get clean, that's the best that can happen. I say go for it. It's a wonderful thing. But I live in the United States. At one time when the World Service Conference met, it was primarily the United States. And addicts got motions on the floor. Today, it's not the United States Conference. It's a World Service Conference, and it needs to continue to be that way. And I don't care if NAWS stays in existence forever and sells basic texts and other literature. They're good at doing that. But they're not good at making decisions for me. Second tradition is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he expresses himself in group conscience. And our leaders are but trusted servants. What does that mean? They're talking about the ultimate authority when a group comes together and has group conscience. And then it says, our leaders are but trusted servants. What does that trusted mean? It means to trust them to carry the group conscience to the next level and not govern. Govern means making decisions for everybody else. And yet you'll hear people say, well, they're our leaders, trust them. Second tradition doesn't say that. It says our leaders are trusted to carry that ultimate authority. They do not govern. And if you think you can manipulate the word govern, look it up in the dictionary. And what we have today is a form of government. Moving now away from on all areas of service on consensus. What is consensus? Well, I'm an old, crusty old man, as I've been called lately the last couple years. And I'm living back 30 years ago. And addiction has different ways of being treated today. And we have to get with the times. Well, I don't know about getting with the times. There was an old movie with James Stewart was in it. Matter of fact, it's from Indiana, Pennsylvania, not very far from here. And the name of the movie was Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. And he was a rookie senator, and he went there. And he studied a little bit about parliamentary procedures and about consensus. And so he decided he wanted to get something done, and nobody wanted to pay attention because he wouldn't play the game. He stood up and started talking what they call a filibuster. And he talked for a couple of days until everybody who didn't want to be there just left because they didn't want to be bothered with this. And who was left were people that supported him, and they took a consensus and they got what they wanted. And for addicts, consensus consciousness is the worst thing that you can happen. Because I'll tell you, traditions protect me from me. Consensus wouldn't. I can manipulate as good as the next guy. And if you give me the tools to manipulate, I will do it. And that's what consensus breeds. It breeds manipulation. Where's their group conscience involved in that? So if you want your fellowship, become part of the fellowship. I don't disrespect anybody's recovery, no matter on what literature you got recovered on. But I say to you, if you want the excitement and you want Narcotics Anonymous for addicts like yourself, literature written, get involved. Lay in your home groups. Get involved. Be part of the process. And say, damn it, the traditions have not been abandoned because there's concepts. The traditions are still there, and we did not vote to get rid of them. Because if you don't take that attitude, you know what's going to happen? Just like when they took stories out of the sixth edition, we voted what stories to put in. How many of you here voted what stories to take out? You weren't asked. They were pulled out. And I believe we need some new stories in there to reflect the addict of today and the drugs of today. But I don't believe we should pull anything out of that book unless we were asked to. And nobody asked me or my home group. No motion came down to where I go for recovery. Little things like that are subtle, and they don't seem to make much sense. But add them up over 25 years, and you are where you are today. When John was sharing about sitting on a table and the V with him on the head, and one side here and one side here, that process started then. And that side there that believed in government has taken over. Why did they want the traditions being taken out of? The ninth tradition where they talked about the explanation of NA as such. Why was that so important for them to take it out? Because the way it was written, look in the second edition of the basic text, or look in the gray book, that gave the power to the groups. Take that out, and it changes into an organizational thing where the power comes from the top. That's why it was so important to get that out. That's why it was so important to have a service manual that reflected government rather than group conscience. Some people say the NA tree was too simple. Well, maybe simplicity is the answer. I'm an addict. And if you complicate anything, I get lost. It doesn't matter how much education I have. I'm an addict. And it's got to be put simple. That's why the basic text in its original form was so beautiful. So absolutely beautiful. Correct grammar, correct English, who the hell cared? When I read a line out of there that says, Narcotics Anonymous does not make sick people well, but brings dead people back to life, every addict understands that. And I can't have the help of the people like Hazelton said, what do they think, to God bringing people back to life? I understand that Narcotics Anonymous brings people, dead people back, because I was spiritually dead when I came in here. There are words in the original text that make your stomach just flutter, and you feel all fuzzy out inside, and you feel on a high from those words in the text. Who cares if it's correct English? It affects the addict and wants them to stay clean. We can edit anything to make it sound proper. But we're people about feelings. Our disease is about not the ability to feel. And we need words that prompt us to feel. And that's why literature is the most important thing in the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. It's more important than anything else I talked about. Because the addict getting in and being part of that process of writing becomes on a spiritual high that you can never come down for. What do you think, like some people can't give up the writing years after the literature committee stopped? Because it not only is addicts helping themselves and addicts helping, it helps your relationship with the God, how you understand them. The 11th step where it said we sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. That's the spiritual high. It tells us that we sought. We are all seekers. We sought through prayer and meditation, which says by the time you get to 11th step, you should have been praying and meditating. For the knowledge of God's will for us. I remember as a newcomer going to conventions and staying up all night and drinking coffee and staying around with other 90-day wonders discussing what God's will is for us. But through the guidance of a sponsor, I found out what God's will for us was. My sponsor told me the magic words. He said, you want to know what God's will is? Step out of the box and become a spectator. Watch the situation of everybody in that situation and say to yourself, what is the highest good for everybody in that situation? That will be God's will. You see, my self-centered ego. And that's why at the end of the step it says, praying for the power to carry it out. Because I may know what's the right thing in God's will, but my self-centeredness wants what I want for me. That was the core of my disease. But the 11th step is what breaks all those barriers. It walks us out to God knows where. We become open-minded. We begin to perceive things we never perceived again in a positive light. If you really want to get on a high, and you want to search that first high that you ever had, do the 11th step on a daily basis. You will have a high beyond anything you've ever experienced. And there are a lot of people in this room that practice that 11th step on a daily basis, and you can talk to any of them, and they'll tell you what the high is. Meditation is not reading a meditation out of a Just for Today book and looking at it. That's contemplation. Yes, it's a form of meditation, but it's not meditation. It's reading something and contemplating on what it means. But in that step, they're telling us something else. Improve our relationship with God through prayer and meditation. Praying for the knowledge of His will for us. Well, you're not going to get that by reading a piece. You're going to get that by going within and making that conscious contact that they talk about. Recovery is a very exciting time. I am just as excited today as I was when I first came into recovery. even though I'm a crusty old man, and even though I believe in things that were in Narcotics Anonymous 30 years ago, if somebody as sick as me can get better, then that stuff just wasn't all that bad. When I look around today and look at the violations of traditions and people justifying it, and the fellowship as a whole not taking a stand, and they're not taking a stand because the fellowship as a whole is you members and you groups and you don't have a say anymore. I can't remember the date the last time a regional motion got on the floor and was heard and passed. Can you remember, Jim, what year it was? I can't remember. But there was a time when that was a regular thing. And we used to sit around and say, you, a new member, can make a motion and change Narcotics Anonymous. I can't say that to people anymore. And as I said, I'm not anti-NAWS and I'm not anti-world. And I believe NAWS has a job to do worldwide because they're dealing with cultures where it's very difficult to recover. And they need to do that and they need to focus on that. But addicts here in the United States need to focus on our conditions here. We need a place where those can be heard. There's all kinds of things going on. People are talking about U.S. Service Conference and the United States Fellowship of Assembly and all kinds of things. And you know what? I don't really give a damn which one comes to pass. But I think as a whole, we need a place to put group conscience again. We need to come unified that we're not against the world. We're pro-NA. And yet I will be condemned for being pro-NA. There were people who will confront me. People will say I'm an outsider. People will say I caused disunity. In my heart, I know I don't. I want what's best for the fellowship. You know, I'm looking 80, you know, coming up. That's the next decade that I'll be going into. I'm not going to be around here forever. You know, it's not that important to me. I don't look for no position. I don't want to be sitting on any board anywhere else. God, I'm a crusty old man. Maybe tomorrow I won't remember my name. But as long as I can remember and know, I want to see this fellowship get excited again and grow and grow. And people have a history conference 30, 40 years from now and say, thank God that those people in 2011 woke up and brought us back to our roots. Brought us back to the thing that made us grow. It's growing in other countries, but it's not growing in the United States. Sure, sign a contract with China, have them buy thousands of basic techs, have the government round up people and make them get clean. It'll grow. But I don't live in those places. And I say, God bless, if you live in those places, if that's the only way you can get clean and function under those rules and those laws, we need to do that. But here in the United States, we need to go back to our roots. We need to go back to group conscience. Yeah, we talk a good game about group conscience. How many people sit at their group's business meeting and do group conscience? I see a few hands going up. But I know a lot of people say, I want to go home and watch the TV show. Do you know when the conference agenda report came out and the fellowship report before that, we used to sit weeks in group conscience things. Everything was important. And then we used to tally it by the groups in the area. Not majority pro and con. We cared. And I'm not saying people don't care today. They have not been exposed to that Narcotics Anonymous. How can they care about something they never known? Grab an old-timer. Talk to them about how it was. They're not going to condemn your recovery because they know what literature you have, you're recovering on it, and you're clean, and that's all that matters. But they could say you could go beyond that. You could go to a place that you could be writing literature. You could be part of it. You could know that your fellowship is in your hands, that you have a say. That's why it was very easy to surrender if you lost the group conscience, because you know it was your fellow addicts that made that decision. They weren't governed. So I want to leave you with those thoughts. What you do is your own personal decisions. I'll love you whether any way you go. And if you disagree with me, you could talk to me and I'll listen to your point of view. I'm not going to say you're going to change my point of view, but I will listen. But give me the courtesy to listen to my point of view also. I'm not going to try to convince you. but I want the opportunity to tell you how I feel and why I feel that way. Because you are important to me. And I love everybody in Narcotics Anonymous. I don't like everybody. I'll be perfectly honest. There are people in Narcotics Anonymous that I want nothing to do with. But most of you I love. And even if I don't like you, I love you and would be there. If you called me up and you had an obsession, I would be there for you, even if I disliked you. Because that's what it's all about, one addict helping the other. Basic text says the ultimate weapon in Narcotics Anonymous is one addict helping another. That's the ultimate weapon. Let's not forget that. And the ultimate thing of recovery is addicts making decisions for the other addicts through consciousness, not through government. If the new service structure passes, and it very well could be, you're not gonna know this fellowship. State assemblies. Pennsylvania has four regions. Can you imagine function under one state assembly? Can you imagine being told where your area lines are grown or are bound? I forget even what they call it, L something or other.
LSU.
Can it work? Maybe it can. Right now we have a hard time working as an area, let alone as a state. It doesn't have to be that way if you decide it's not going to be that way. And if you decide it's going to be that way, when I say you decide means by you not saying anything, not making any waves on it, then that's your decision. We have regions today where it's hard to get business done. Can you imagine that? The whole state meeting as a state? I think they're taking like 67 regions and combining it into 27 state assemblies. Because some of the smaller states will be multi-state. It will not only be their state, it'll be multi-state. That's one hell of a fart. Unbelievable. But yet, if you don't say something, then that's your conscience. And if you read history someday and say, those people used to sit down and take group conscience. What happened? Well, Emerson wrote an essay one time called History. And in that essay, he talks about if you don't know your history, the mistakes that history made, you will repeat again. Know your history. Know how we got to where we are. Know how it can change. And will that change benefit you or will it hurt you? Those are questions only you can answer. I'm not complaining. I'm just giving you the facts. You know, just like that Sergeant Friday said on that show, Dragnet, just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. Because that's all I'm doing. I can't tell you how to vote. I can't tell you how to think. I'm not government. But damn it, as long as I come to Narcotics Anonymous, I will tell you how I feel about things. And give me the courtesy to do that, because I will listen to you talk about what you feel, even if it's 100% different than what I do. And I hear that often. Well, I don't want to hear what you have to say. This is how it should be. And that also comes from the part that supports group conscience, too. There are people in there that will cut you off in a second and try to tell you what's right for you. No, I say, here's the facts. Take a look at it. Is this where you want your fellowship to go? If this is where you want your fellowship to go, God bless you. If it's not where you want your fellowship to go, get involved. If it's going to be, it's up to me. Each one individually needs to say that to themselves, no matter what your stance is on it. But I'll tell you one thing. If you take a stance on group conscience, there will be people who will ridicule you, will try to get rid of you, will ask you not to come around. But you earned your chair there. Don't leave before you see the next miracle and the next phase of Narcotics Anonymous. Thanks for letting me share.